This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Humanity is in the hot seat. Today, the World Meteorological Organization and the European Commission's Copernicus Climate Change Service are releasing official data that confirms that July 2023 is set to be the hottest month ever recorded in human history. We don't have to wait for the end of the month to know this. Short of a mini ice age over the next days, July 2023 will shatter records across the board. According to the data released today, July has already seen the hottest three-week period ever recorded, the three hottest days on record, and the highest ever ocean temperatures for this time of year. The consequences are clear and they are tragic. Children swept away by monsoon rains, families running from the flames, workers collapsing in scorching heat. For vast parts of North America, Asia, Africa, and Europe, it's a cruel summer. For the entire planet, it is a disaster. And for scientists, it is unequivocal. Humans are to blame. All this is entirely consistent with predictions and repeated warnings. The only surprise is the speed of the change. Climate change is here, it is terrifying, and it is just the beginning. The era of global warming has ended, the era of global boiling has arrived. The air is unbreathable, the heat is unbearable, and the level of fossil fuel profits and climate inaction is unacceptable. Leaders must lead. No more hesitancy, no more excuses, no more waiting for the others to move first. There is simply no more time for that.
That was Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the UN July 27, 2023. U.S. President Joe Biden called a rare press event about the amazing heat blasting the U.S. South and now East. Maybe the leaders are finally taking some heat themselves. The world record hottest ocean temperature was just measured off Florida. The Mediterranean just set a new heat record. A rural area of China set a blistering new heat high never seen before in that country with 52.2 degrees Celsius, 126 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. Billions of people are suffering through long-lasting heat waves around all the northern hemisphere. Something strange is happening. Nobody saw this coming. I'm Alex Smith. This week we have two new guest interviews and a fast report on the weird weather on Greenland from the world's best, Jason Box.
Radio EcoShock.
Just as billions of people suffer through the world's first record around-the-planet heat wave, American writer Jeff Goodell strikes with his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Jeff's book is already on the New York Times bestseller list. We last talked with Goodell after his 2017 book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. That was a New York Times critic's top book of 2017. Often published in Rolling Stone magazine, Jeff is a journalist's journalist. Jeff Goodell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was going to say, what are the odds your heat book lands during a record heat wave? But in 2023, I guess the odds were pretty good. Still, you must be stunned by what is happening with the global heat these days.
Yeah, it's a little strange and a little eerie, having spent 4 years writing this book and having it coming out at the same moment as we have this global heat wave. It feels a little bit like I'm living in my own Stephen King novel. But, you know, I wrote this book because I understood, as anybody would who thought much about this, that our planet was getting hotter and hotter as we continue to burn fossil fuels, and that dealing with heat, both in a personal way and a kind of planetary way, it was going to become more and more urgent of an issue.
So what caused you, though, to shift your focus from rising seas to heat?
Well, actually, you know, it began at a very sort of simple and clear moment for me. I happened to be in Arizona, in Phoenix, in 2019. I had some meetings there for a different climate story I was working on, and I took a walk downtown to one of these meetings on I think the temperature was about 115 degrees, and I had to walk about 12 blocks. And by the time I got to the end of the 12 blocks, my heart was pounding, and I was feeling a little dizzy, and I realized, oh, my gosh, this heat is incredible. And I'd never really thought about what that heat meant to a human body and how easy it was, how dangerous it was, and what the risks were. And it was sort of surprising to me because I'd been, by that time, writing about climate change for more than a decade. I knew all about, you know, obviously about global warming and the impacts of warmth, but I had never really thought about heat. And the book was really born of that moment.
So what is heat, really? We can't see it. We can't hear it. We can't directly smell it. What is it?
That's an interesting question, and it's one that I sort of thought about in the aftermath of that moment walking on the streets in Phoenix when I realized that even though I had been a climate journalist for a long time, I couldn't describe what heat was. You know, I obviously knew what temperature was, as we all do, but heat, what is heat itself? And it turns out there is a big question in the history of science. There was a lot of debate in the 18th and 19th centuries about, you know, what actually heat is, and was it a invisible wave? Was it some kind of fluid? The word calorie actually comes out of this idea, this caloric theory that hypothesized that it was this invisible fluid that moved between objects. But the short version of it is what heat is vibration. When something is hotter, the molecules vibrate faster, and when we touch a hot coffee cup or a hot steering wheel or something, what's happening is the molecules in that steering wheel or the coffee cup are vibrating faster, and that energy, that vibration is transferred to the molecules in our fingertips, which our brains register as heat.
You know, I talked with a doctor in Hawaii who found 27 different ways that heat can kill people in the body, reactions from organs to all sorts of things. And in 2004, a killer heat wave in Europe killed about 70,000 people. And I was shocked to see a new report just came out recently that 62,000 deaths in the EU were attributed to heat in last year, 2022. Do we know, Jeff, how many people are killed by heat around the world?
No, we do not. And we don't. And I would argue, after talking to many public health officials around the world, not only do we not have any kind of precise figure, we don't even really have a good idea. When you talk about kind of global heat mortality statistics, most of Africa is not even included. And obviously, lots of people die in Africa from extreme heat, just as they do in the rest of the world, but there's simply no accounting. And, you know, in addition to that, heat is not like a gun. It doesn't leave a wound that you can say, oh, that's where the bullet went in, this person died of a gunshot. With heat, people who die of heat stroke often die first. What first happens is their heart goes out because of the stress that dealing with heat puts on their hearts. And so they, by one definition, they died of a heart attack. And it's only when you consider the context with which that heart attack happened that you understand that it was really driven by extreme heat. So these mortality numbers, these statistics, are just a kind of vague outline of what we're dealing with.
Well, for once and for all, are some races or bodies adapted to heat? Are they able to work outside safely when others cannot? What did you find?
No. The answer to that is no. That was a big issue during the 19th century, during slavery. There was this idea that black people evolved in Africa and that they were somehow better equipped for heat, so they're working in the cotton field during these really hot days, it didn't impact them the way it impacted, you know, other people. We see remnants of that here in Texas, where I live, where there's a lot of Mexican workers who are working on road crews and construction crews. And there's this sort of unspoken idea that it doesn't affect them as much. Not true. One of the things that I found in reporting this book is there is different vulnerability to heat, depending on, like, how old you are, how strong your heart is. Body shape can have an impact. You know, taller, slender people generally do better than heavier, shorter people. And there are other factors, like if you're taking medications and things like that. But there's no genetic difference between someone who has comes from ancestry in Africa or someone who comes from ancestry in Canada. We're dealing with heat. We have the same cooling system. We have the same number of sweat glands. We all suffer from extreme heat.
And I find judging heat by the number of human deaths is misleading, as you say, partly because nobody really counts the heat deaths as such. But many governments also adapt with cooling centers and all that, so heat deaths might actually go down in one region, even as temperatures go up, until the grid goes down. And in your book, you write, I just want to read this one sentence, if the blackout continues for more than 36 hours or so, it's likely the National Guard will need to be called in to maintain order and control widespread looting and general mayhem. What do you base that on? Is that mainly an American experience, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, that's, first of all, that whole passage about the consequences of a blackout during an extreme heat event come from a conversation I had with an infrastructure expert at University of Arizona who had thought a lot about this. But, you know, the kind of ongoing chaos of what happens during a blackout is, there's plenty of evidence of that during blackouts in history, you know, blackouts in New York City, you know, riots, looting, all kinds of things like that. There's lots of historic sort of evidence of that. But, you know, what's not widely appreciated is how vulnerable we are. We think that we are people who live in hot places, like I'm talking to you from Austin, Texas, where it's a very hot place. You know, we had a 5-day blackout here in the middle of winter, you know, a couple of years ago. And because it's Texas and not, you know, northern Canada, still a number of people died. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. But if that kind of 5-day blackout happened here on an extreme heat week like we're having right now, you know, people's air conditioning would go out. There would be a lot of death. There would be a lot of suffering. It would be catastrophic in a very obvious and profound way. You know, our houses are not built with natural ventilation in mind. We have this idea that air conditioning can protect us, and when the power goes out, that doesn't happen.
Well, let's go back to Phoenix as a case study. The city had almost a month where the daily high was at least 110 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, 43 degrees C. The nighttime heat didn't go below 90 degrees or 32 C. And in fact, Phoenix set a new record all-time nighttime low for the United States at 97 degrees Fahrenheit, the coldest they had that particular night. Oh, my God. That's punishing, and it's extra dangerous if it keeps going with no low night times to cool people off, isn't it?
That's right. That's a really important point that a lot of people don't grasp, you know, because dealing with heat is strenuous for our body. You know, the way that that our bodies deal with heat is by, you know, our heart pumping faster to move our blood away from our internal organs and out towards the surface of our skin so that it can be cooled by sweating. And that's the mechanism that our body uses. And within a certain temperature range, and, you know, as long as you're relatively healthy, it works pretty well. But even for normal, healthy people in moderate conditions, it's a lot of extra strain. And when you don't have cooling off at night, usually if you do have cooling off at night, your body gets a break, everything gets to rest, and the stress on your body is reduced. But if you have high nighttime temperatures, especially if it's combined with any kind of particular vulnerability on your part of your body, whether it's because of a heart condition or drugs you're taking or whatever, it really becomes much more dangerous more quickly. It's just like, you know, going for a long walk or something, and when you get tired, not being able to stop and take a rest, and it gets much more difficult if you're not able to recover for these brief periods.
And I know lots of listeners are thinking, well, I don't live in Phoenix. And that's what I thought until the heat reached almost 50 degrees C, 122 Fahrenheit, right here in British Columbia, Canada. As we heat the planet, do you think a lot of cities could get like Phoenix?
Well, I think that a lot of cities are vulnerable to extreme heat waves that have never imagined that before. You know, what happened in the Pacific Northwest in 2021 was a textbook example of that, as you know better than I do. But the wonderfully temperate climate, no one imagined there could be temperatures of 50 C in British Columbia. And yet it happened. And, you know, it underscores one of the most important points of this whole conversation and understanding kind of where we're at climate-wise now, is that because of the amount of CO2 we've put into the atmosphere, which has changed the kind of atmospheric dynamics related to the temperature gradients between the equator and the poles, and it has changed the jet stream, and it's mucking around with a lot of the basic physics of our atmosphere. We're not going back to the climate that, you know, we grew up in. We're living in an entirely new climate, and what those rules are for this new climate are not at all clear. And that means that, you know, we can expect extreme events, whether heat waves are a classic example, but also extreme rainfall and things like that, in places that we didn't used to think about them happening. And kind of basically all bets are off. And as you saw in British Columbia and Washington State and in Oregon, when that heat wave hit, people didn't know what to do. People didn't understand how to react. Most houses don't have air conditioning. You know, they're really unprepared for it. And I think one of the lessons of my book is that we need to be prepared. Everybody needs to be prepared. It's not just a Texas or a Phoenix thing. You know, it's everyone.
And despite being water-threatened and heat-battered, more people are moving to Phoenix. How is that possible, and when does that end?
Well, that's a good question about when it ends. But, you know, people are driven to Phoenix for a lot of reasons, and same thing to Texas. You know, I moved here to Austin 4 years ago. I lived in upstate New York until then, in a much cooler and sort of more climate-friendly place. But I fell in love with a woman who lived here, and I wanted to be with her. And it was better to be in a hot place with the person that I cared about than being in a cooler place, you know, at a distance from her. So people's reasons for moving are, you know, very complex: jobs, closeness to relatives. In the case of Phoenix, there's traditionally been a lot of relatively inexpensive real estate. There's been a lot of jobs companies that have moved there because of that, big warehouses and stuff and factories in the surrounding region, lower tax rates, a lot of things like that. Plus, there's this general idea that, you know, people generally prefer warmer weather than cooler weather. I mean, you know, not everybody, but in general, that's true. People would like to be in a place where they can wear shorts every day and walk outside. And the thing that's changing, though, is these sort of nice warm temperatures are rapidly becoming dangerous temperatures. And there's a big difference between, you know, hanging out in Phoenix on a 95-degree day and hanging out in Phoenix on a 115-degree day.
But it seems like the first wave of heat deaths are really a social problem. Rich people turn up the AC. Their streets have lots of trees. Over a billion people don't have AC or can't afford to pay the electric bill if they did. Talk to us about heat and social justice, Jeff.
Well, that's a really important point. You know, heat is predatory. Heat preys on the most vulnerable in our population, whether it's people who are older and who are not in as good a physical health and therefore more vulnerable to the stress that heat puts on our bodies, or whether it's outdoor workers, agricultural workers. I wrote about the death of an agricultural worker in Oregon during the 2021 heat wave in the Pacific Northwest in my book. You know, delivery people, postal carriers, you know, roads crews, construction crews, all those people, which keep our society rolling and you know, allow the rest of us to sit in our air-conditioned offices and do our work. All those people in the sort of outdoors are extremely vulnerable to these changes. And so are, you know, people who can't afford air conditioning, don't have access to air conditioning. You know, I spent some time in Phoenix in some of the poorer neighborhoods. And, you know, I remember sitting in an apartment with a woman on a very, very hot day. And, you know, she had an air conditioner in her house. It was an old one, and it was on a meter. And she was trying to decide whether she should put another $10 into it and cool her apartment down for a few more hours, or whether she could afford that or not. And, you know, she was constantly arbitraging between having enough money to buy food and having enough money to run her air conditioner. So, you know, in the book, I really talk about this line between the cooled and the damned, that there really is a difference between those of us who can find refuge away from the heat and others who, for a variety of circumstances and reasons, can't. And heat makes that line very clear.
And Vancouver just built a zillion apartments and condos in downtown towers. The walls are made entirely of glass, And due to safety regulations, windows can only open 4 inches. It's about as heat unfriendly as you can imagine. Is it fair to say the invention of the air conditioner made us forget how to design heat-ready cities?
Yeah, it's absolutely fair to say that. I mean, in the book, I talk about air conditioning as a technology of forgetting. We knew how to do this, how to build buildings with natural air circulation, how to cool things off. You know, in the 16th century in the Middle East, in Iran and Iraq, you know, they were able to use wind towers, these like big chimneys that captured wind. And by using carefully designed wind circulation patterns throughout the buildings that went down into a basement where there was cool water that would chill out the air and recycle it through the house, they built these sort of natural air conditioning systems that worked so well that they could actually make ice in the 16th century from this sort of natural circulation of air. But we've forgotten all about how to do that. And, you know, we throw up these buildings like the one you're talking about in Vancouver that are designed to be sealed up. They're designed to be airtight. In some ways, some of the, you know, efficiency standards work against any kind of idea of natural cooling because you want the building as tightly sealed as possible. And, you know, that works all well and good until the air conditioning fails. And then those kinds of buildings become convection ovens and very dangerous very quickly. You know, I had a conversation with a very famous architect a couple of weeks ago whose name I don't want to use because it was off the record. We were just having dinner together, conversation, but I was complaining about air conditioning and building these kinds of buildings like the one you're talking about in Vancouver. And he said, well, we absolutely know how to build buildings that use natural air circulation. And, you know, we don't need to air condition these kinds of buildings. We can do it another way. But he said, you know, all of my clients demand air conditioning. They all demand that they can keep the temperature at exactly 72 or 71 degrees. They don't want to have to deal with any kind of variability, anything like that. They just want comfort. And, you know, that's really the heart of the problem.
And you literally went to the end of the Earth to witness this planet heating up. Tell us about your trip to Antarctica and key lessons there.
Well, I was very fortunate. I was able to go on this 7-week cruise. There was a joint effort between U.S. scientists and the British Antarctic Survey on a ship to West Antarctica to investigate what was happening or what is happening to a glacier called Thwaites Glacier, which is kind of an enormous glacier that is the cork in the wine bottle for the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, which if it melted, would just that one ice sheet itself would raise sea levels 10 feet. Around the world, which is, you know, basically catastrophic for virtually every coastal city. But I went down there to look at what even just small changes in heat, the implications of that. And what I found was, and what the scientists found out that I was on a trip with, was really, you know, kind of remarkable, because the short version of it is a change in the Southern Ocean temperature of 1 degree Fahrenheit, hardly perceptible, 1 degree, has changed the ice and water dynamics beneath these glaciers and allowed the ocean water to begin to melt underneath the glaciers and flow down under the glaciers, which is destabilizing these enormous glaciers from below, making them much more likely to kind of crack up like a giant tray of ice cubes and sort of fall into the Southern Ocean, this kind of idea of scientists call ice cliff collapse. It's just really important because I wanted to demonstrate that even small changes in temperature, which we think of as being inconsequential, you know, what's 1 degree in the ocean, can have enormous consequences for people thousands of miles away and for really how we think about our cities and where we can live and where we can't.
In your book, you ask a question weighing heavy on my own mind, quote, with today's level of warming, are there any breaks on the atmospheric system that prevent a heat wave beyond any we've experienced or imagined, end quote. What did you find?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, I was very curious with a simple question, which is, you know, how hot can it get? Climate models are very good and have been proven to be very good, even in these extreme conditions we're seeing right now, at charting out kind of general warming given a certain level of CO2 and everything. And the climate models have really proved themselves. But what they haven't been able to model so well is these sort of extreme events, you know, these extreme temperatures like you had in British Columbia in 2021. And what I wanted to know was, is there any physical limits on how extreme these heat waves can get right now with the amount of CO2 and everything we have in the atmosphere. So forgetting about whether we cut CO2 or add the CO2, just like right now where we are. You know, because we had a temperature jump in that Antarctica of 70 degrees 2 years ago, above average down there. You know, if we had a temperature jump of, this is Fahrenheit, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, of that kind of thing in a place like Austin or Phoenix, that would just be, you know, absolutely catastrophic. And the answer to the question that I got from talking to the world's top scientists about this is we don't know what the upper limits are. They don't know what the upper limits are. There's no physical mechanism that says here's how hot it can get. They all said we're highly, virtually impossible to get a 70-degree jump. We're not going to get, you know, heat waves of 180 degrees in Phoenix or Austin anytime soon. But could we get, you know, a temperature of 52, 50, I'm switching back to centigrade, 52, 53 in a place like Phoenix or Austin or Houston or one of these hot places? It's possible. And so that's really terrifying in the kind of world we're creating for ourselves where we don't know what the boundaries really are.
Well, this is one of the weird things, though. Millions of people in the American South are roasting day after day, and yet there's still a strong current of climate denialism there, and people saying, well, no, this is just nature. What can you do? What do you think it will take, Jeff Goodell, for the United States and the world to act as though the climate emergency is real?
Well, I don't think there's going to be a one wake-up moment. You know, I don't think there's going to be a time when the world, whatever the event is, whether it's a heat waves or hurricanes or whatever, droughts or whatever, there's not going to be, I don't think there's going to be a kind of mass awakening. I think that, you know, this is a long, hard slog. People are becoming more and more aware of it. You look at the polling and things, and the number of climate kind of deniers are staying more or less the same when you look at these polls, but the number of people who understand that the climate crisis is real and is happening is growing, and, you know, that's all to the good. The problem is it's not growing fast enough, and the urgency of taking action is still really not there. There's a lot of doomerism. There's a lot of people who are beginning to say, you know, we're really screwed. This is evidence that we're really screwed. This is hopeless. There's nothing we can do. You know, I'm just going to hang out in my basement and wring my hands about the future of human civilization. I think the doomerism is also very dangerous. And, you know, what it will take to kind of inspire the kind of political action that we need, which is really what we're talking about now. The economics of clean energy are so clear. The economics of adaptation are so clear. We need more dramatic political action right now, and that's what we're still lacking, is that kind of political leadership.
Wrapping up, your book suggests we don't really know heat, and you offer stories to help understand. Is that fair? And why do you say the heat will kill you first?
Well, you know, I understand that it's a controversial title, but I really wanted to call the name for this to be the title of the book for two reasons. One is that when you look at other climate impacts, it's really heat that is the most dangerous risk to you as a person today. You know, my previous book was about sea level rise. We talked about that one, you know, about my book when that came out. We had a conversation on the show about it. Sea level rise has a lot of consequences to our world, including, you know, real estate values and where people are going to live and migration and all that kind of stuff. But no one's going to stand on Miami Beach and drown in real time because something, you know, an ice chunk dropped off in Greenland that afternoon, right? The risk to human life from something like sea level rise is non-existent. It's a long-term reshaping of our civilization. Heat is the exact opposite of that. It's something that can kill you now. And my book has a number of stories of people who were killed by heat stroke, by extreme heat, people who are knowledgeable about heat, even people who, you know, were experienced. It's very, very dangerous. And as we get into these higher temperatures now, it becomes more and more dangerous. So I think it's really urgent that, you know, all of us, whatever we think about the politics of climate change and energy and all that kind of stuff, we're dealing with a hotter world, and we have to understand what those risks are. And the last thing I'll say is I wanted the title to be deliberately provocative in the sense that it's about you because and me, because a lot of the writing about climate change and everything is very good, but very kind of distant. And, you know, this is something that's going to happen to our world in the future. And, you know, a lot of people think it's going to happen to somebody else who lives far away and, you know, they're sorry for them. But